You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to another episode of Ethnosinology. My name is David Ian Howe. I'm an anthropologist and archaeologist. And today I had put out a call on my Instagram and my TikTok and my YouTube for a call for questions people could submit. And I'm going to answer them here. Not just a Q&A about me, but Q&A about dogs. And we're going to go through 10 of them. So let's just call this Archaeologist Answers 10 Questions About the Past and Dogs. All right, let's get cooking. We have no idea, and by we, I mean the collective we as a human species, but also archaeologists, have no way of determining that until written writing. We can look through oral tradition, and we can ask through indigenous oral tradition or Aboriginal Australia, where dogs named. It's a little different in Aboriginal Australia, because a lot of times you can't name names once someone is deceased, depends on which nation it is. In the Americas, there are names for dogs. It usually has something to do with their occupation, I guess, like runs fast. I know that sounds like a joke, but it's not. Sometimes that is the dog's name. But that is the in terms of a society where there is no written language, but we do definitively know that in Mesopotamia and in Rome and Greece and stuff, dogs did have names and they're written down. In fact, some of the famous epitaphs of dogs, one of them is, Mia never barked without reason, but now she is silent. So we know the dog's name was Mia. And then I'm going to try to recite this from memory, but there is, my eyes were with tears, our little dog, when I carried you to your grave. So Patricus, never can you give me 1,000 kisses, never again can you sit contentedly in my lap. In sadness have I buried you, and you deservest in a resting place of marble. I have put you for all of time by the side of my shade. One, damn. Two, Patricus, or I guess Patricus would be the dog's name in ancient Roman or Latin. That one's a cool one. And then there is also one, its name's not Rex, it's something like that. Here the stone says it holds the white dog from Melita, the most faithful guardian of Eumelus. Eumelus, I believe is how you say that. Bull, they called him when he was yet alive, but now his voice is imprisoned in the silent pathways of the night. Damn times two. That one's rough. And then there's another one, I want to say. Bull, Mia, Patricus. Surely, even as thou liest dead in this tomb, I deem thee wild beast, yet fear thy white bones. Okay, no name on that one, but still goes hard. But that was dogs being named in the past. And again, we probably can infer somehow through oral traditions if you ask what the dog's name was. And again, the dog's name at the time, like 7,000 years ago, might have been like, you know, John. But as that story gets passed through oral tradition, the dog's name could become Runs Fast or something like that. And there's a lot of dogs like that in Indigenous American society. And I will say, in the Arctic, only a few, and this depends on the tribe or the nation, but some dogs were not allowed, most dogs were not allowed a name. But when you gave a dog a name, it gave it a soul. And there was only like a few dogs that were selected to have that. It just depended on their temperament and their upbringing and which ones were allowed to live with people in society. So I hope that answers that question. We can move on to the next. Could dogs have influenced human language or not? I think this one, much like did dogs influence human society and, you know, did dogs influence human evolution? I always preface this one. I see people say that dogs evolved alongside with us. We evolved alongside dogs. Humans haven't genetically been around, dogs haven't genetically been around long enough for dogs to have impacted human evolution, I think. We kind of look the same as we did 20,000 years ago when dogs were domesticated, but they can definitely change our social evolution. And for sure, dogs, and I say this all the time, except for South America, every place where civilization or quote unquote civilization sprung up, dogs existed beforehand. And even in South America, where dogs didn't exist when they started farming potatoes and things in the high mountains of the Andes, dogs were already domesticated and helped humans get to the Americas. I think that goes without saying. But I think in South America is the only place where you can definitively see civilization, quote unquote, pop up where dogs didn't exist at that formation, you know? But they're also, besides, I think, mountain lions in South America, and I think there's sun bears. Those might be in India. There's some kind of bear in South America. Bears and large cats. There's not a lot of predators and certainly not a lot of aggressive other people. The very first civilization. But in South America, as we know, that 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 quickly changed with the Wari and all that. So they got a little rough. They got a little silly with the cutting people up with stone tools and stuff, but that's besides the point. So did dogs influence human language? Probably not. I think, though, wolf social evolution and wolf social cognition and social ability and the way they communicate with each other with their pecking order and their system of hierarchy and things like that in the wild did influence human society in a way, or at least we found kinship, as I talked about with Anjali Ratnadive in the previous episode. Yeah, I don't think dogs could have influenced human language that much, though I will say one fun fact here is that you can kind of track dog, the word for it, across the ancient world, and it's pretty similar. It's Senos in Greek. It's canis in Latin, or lupus for wolf, and then in Hebrew and Arabic, it's kelev is dog, so ka there. You can see that, and that might come from, like, an onomatopoeia of dogs being like, kuh, like barking. I don't know. That, forget I said that, but it could be. I'm just hypothesizing here, but I would love one day to track dog across how it tracks across the ancient world, or that language, the word for it spreads. But where I wanted to go with this is, interestingly, the word dog in modern English, they don't know where that comes from. It might be like not Basque, but some weird version of a Celtic language that kind of stuck around, because it would be canus or canis if it came from dog. Perro as well. In Spanish, they also are unsure of exactly where that comes from, but dog and perro and tam. I'm so good. Dog and perro is, it's interesting. I think perro has a more trackable lineage of where you can find it, but dog, it does not come from Norse. It does not come from Latin. It possibly does not come from Celtic, because in Celtic and Gaelic, I think it's like Quone or something like that. What's the guy? The blood of Cú Chulainn, I think, is that Cú is dog. So there, Cú, Celtic, Caniv, Caliv, it's all similar, but dog is its weird own one. So interesting fact there. Are we domesticating ourselves the same way we domesticated dogs? And that's an interesting question, because I do get this one often, and I don't buy it in the sense that humans are being domesticated and bred smaller and smaller and less hairless with bigger eyes. Maybe we are, in a sense, if you're looking at, you know, zooming out from what Neanderthals look like, or the way a chimp looks at Goodall, it's like a naked ape with huge eyes. So that is interesting. It's the same way we look at the grays, like the aliens in like Roswell, the typical alien with the huge gray head and the giant black eyes. That's how a chimp looks at us. But I don't think we're domesticating ourselves. I will say, though, much like I said in the previous answer, that everywhere civilization, quote unquote, I'm just going to stop saying quote unquote, but everywhere civilization pops up, large scale urban societies, dogs already existed, or at least were domesticated beforehand. And with that, I think dogs helped people be more sedentary. You don't have to keep moving around place to place as much once you have dogs, because you have dogs that can help, one, get caloric energy in the form of hunting, help you get more calories and help you have more of a settlement and, you know, get more bang for your buck in a certain area, because it's getting you access to prey you wouldn't see before. Like, they can find snakes and rabbits and stuff in the ground that you wouldn't have seen before because they can sniff it out. So a little extra calories there, but not a lot. And again, that's debated depending on where you are. It's environmentally dependent. But dogs do help you settle. And we know dogs help settle the Americas. Actually, we don't know that for a fact. Genetically, we do. We just haven't found one that old yet. So I'm torn on that one. Genetically, dogs exist in the Americas with Clovis, but there's no evidence physical of it yet. But we do know genetically dogs are there. So that is... that's a fun fact, but dogs can help flush hyenas out of caves, they can help protect against lions, they help you stay in one settlement, and they're also a deterrent from other people sneaking up at night. Because no longer can someone come up to your cave or come up to your mammoth hut village in the middle of the night without a dog barking. And that instantly upped human society, I think. So, were they domesticating us, though? I don't think so. Why do humans cry over dogs more than any other animal? A great question. The first and foremost, most obvious answer is dogs are the most intrinsically linked animal to human society, even more than the horse, even more than the cat. Dogs are just, have been around longer, 10,000 years longer than cats, 17,000 years longer than horses, really. So more than that, I think it's like 18,000 years longer than horses. But this one says, how much of archaeology is actual excavation versus lab work and data analysis? That is a great question, because I would say most of archaeology, if archaeology was an iceberg, this is excavation. The rest of it is data analysis and going through the collections with middle range theory of looking through archaeological collections and getting big data answers of questions. And again, archaeology is not going out and finding artifacts. It's not just collecting things and bringing them back like antiquarians did in the 1800s and 1700s. It's not like that. You're going out and asking a question. Now, there are some sites where it has to be dug out and you want to preserve the site by excavating it in that sense, like carefully documenting every single, the angle at which each artifact is laid, the position it is and on GPS, but also north, south, and east and west on a coordinate with the datum of the site. You want to get all that information to take that site. And a lot of it is dirt, obviously, right? Not all of it is artifacts. That'd be crazy if it all was. You're taking those artifacts, bringing them back to the lab or bringing them back to the collections facility, and the rest of that dirt and stuff, except for a few some samples, gets tossed out, you know, or at least is backfilled into the site. And the way it was deposited, it's like it's drawn out, it's graphed, it's photographed extensively, so we have exactly what was there. The rest of it is gone. So it depends on the site, because some sites it's minimal. You're doing a minimal amount of excavation where you're just taking the artifacts out and leaving the rest of it for someone else to check later. But it just depends on the salvage, especially if, let's say, Walmart is putting a new building in, that archaeological site has to be dug out so Walmart can put their site there, you know? So it just depends on what that is doing. But yeah, I would say a lot of, if not most of, and I would say 90% to 99%, I keep jumping this number up and repeating what I'm saying, is not excavation. It is lab work, data analysis, and middle range theory. So that's that answer. What archaeological discovery completely changed human history? I forgot about this one. I think I read this one and was like, let me come back to that. And I never started thinking about it again. This is a tough one. I don't really think there is one. I mean, it depends on what kind of archaeology you're talking about. I mean, King Tut's tomb is obviously extremely important to Egyptology or Egyptology, you know, Egypt archaeology. But is there any one site that's like just completely fundamentally like, whoa? I don't know. I would just say like, it's environmentally and contextually dependent. Like Laprelle, the one I worked on in Wyoming, gives us a really, really cool snapshot and very verbose and detailed illustration of what human life was like in the Ice Age in the Americas. I can see that there is Ice Age hunters following bison and mammoth, hunting them, making stone tools to do that, going miles and miles or kilometers away, like a week's walk away to get stone to come back there to process this mammoth, or they got that stone first and had it in their toolkit when they were there working these stones, making scrapers to tan the hides. There's red ochre everywhere, probably for dyeing the hides or at least preserving them in some way. You have a lot of stone tools. There's different animals, and we talked about in the Laprelle videos with the bone needle video, and then the second one with McKenna. The bone needle is probably one of the most important technologies in human history in terms of humans migrating across the world. So that's extremely important. But that is a fundamental discovery in the Americas, I think. You could also say, like, you know, all the archaeological sites in Peru are just astronomically cool. Way remote out in the farthest continent away, besides Australia, really. But, I mean, the tip of South America is the farthest from Africa I think humans could get. On foot, you know, it's the complete other side of the world, in two southward facing continents, you know. So those are just cool on their own. But the Antikythera mechanism maybe is just shows that the people back then had computing power or understood that, if that's what that is. But, you know, I can't really tell you. It's contextually dependent. And I know that's probably a cop-out answer, but that's probably the best answer I can give you on that one. Did Neanderthals have dogs? That's a great question. I think Pat Shipman's book, The Invaders, is an interesting book that talks about this, whether humans... The thesis of her book is that humans coming into parts of Europe where Neanderthals existed, bringing with them dogs, helped drive or just forced Neanderthals out, essentially, the same way humans flushed hyenas out of caves. It's not that humans were like, you know, sicking dogs on people like the police or the, you know, SEAL Team 6, sicking them on Neanderthals. But they were in a sense, displacing those populations there, if this theory is correct, with dogs, because they had a lot more ecological benefit and could cover more ground, essentially, with better technology, dogs being a technology, but projectile weapons, trapping, hide tanning, making, you know, warm clothing, thermoregulatory garments, and things like that. Humans can move into those areas and displace the Neanderthals. However, the caveat to that is we only have dogs genetically 20,000 years ago. So Neanderthals went extinct 40,000 years ago. And by extinct, I mean we genetically merged with them, genetically coalesced, I guess would be the word. Coalesced via copulation. There you go. I think that's the way I phrased it on Sebastian's podcast. But that is what happened. But dogs didn't exist then. However, dogs may have been starting to domesticate themselves at that time. Wolves coming closer to human camps, eating, staying around for a little bit, not biting people, and then leaving and going back to their dens and territories later. Could have been happening for as long as humans have been out of Africa. So Neanderthals possibly could have had wolves, domestic wolves at least. There's just no evidence of it genetically. And then we start seeing dog remains and like definitive dog burial stuff around 14 to 10,000 years ago spring up all over Europe, the Near East, and Siberia. So I guess that could answer that question. What animals came closest to being the dog in terms of status? Excellent question as well. And I think, I mean, the most standard answer that you're probably thinking of right now, in fact, I'll give you 2 seconds to think of it. One, two, cats, horses, I would say. Now, you could also argue goats, you could also argue sheep and cows, depending on what kind of history or what the answer is you're looking for. But in terms of animals that live with us day in and day out, it'd be cats and dogs, right? I think cats being a social carnivore, but they're kind of antisocial in their own way. They can live on their own, but they do live just fine in not cat herds. I did see cat herds in the Middle East. That was wild. And in Greece. But they're just like swarms of cats everywhere, but kind of like street dogs are. But yeah, cats and dogs are the most intrinsic to human life every day. But I would also say the horse. Like, I mean, a human on top of a horse with a sword and a chariot behind you, or on the chariot with, you know, a sword in your hand, is a horrifyingly interesting concept. You know, you're using this animal to pull you faster and you're attacking other people with it. It's like you're becoming one with the horse in that sense. And then, as we talked about in the horse episode, horses did the same thing, or the stirrup did the same thing. Once you had the stirrup, you had a lot more control of the horse. It freed up your hands. You could steer the horse with your feet in a way. Some people do that. I know that's not the... There's many different ways of horse riding, right? But there's Western, bareback, and then, you know, European. But just the stirrup allowed knights to dig into the horse, hold a shield, and then hold a lance with one hand and just, you know... Coursers could go in and do their thing. You could also shoot a bow much better when you have stirrups and things like that, but some people didn't even use stirrups, like the Apache or the Comanche. They just barebacked it with a bow and arrow, which is crazy ab work, I think. But yeah, the horse, the cat, and the dog. That's a superficial answer. That wasn't even the answer to the question. What came close? Yeah, the cat and the horse. Goats being the first domestic animal, I think, or the first domestic, you know, livestock, then led to sheep and cattle and pigs and things like that too. So you could argue the goat. What dog breed today is closest to ancient dogs? Great question. The dingo. I was just the first and foremost answer. That is the most, I wouldn't say the most archaic dog breed, but it is the most what a dog was 20,000 years ago. If you look at dingoes in the wild, and they will come up to human camps and eat stuff and things like that, and they'll interact with Aboriginal people as well, or did in the past, and they'll interact with European Australians as well. But, yeah, I think the dingo is a great example, but in terms of the Americas, the Greenland sled dog is the most ancient breed with the most ancient DNA from the time dogs are domesticated. The American dingo, the Carolina swamp dog as well. Charlotte's Quinteleys and Chihuahuas have very ancient DNA too, but the oldest dog DNA, I think, and the oldest, most, maybe not oldest DNA, but the oldest and most like consistent breeds are like the Chow Chow and the Shar Pei in China. Like they have very ancient dog genetics that correlate to the dogs that came from just north of them in Siberia where dogs were domesticated. So that does make sense. What's one archaeological myth or conception that drives archaeologists crazy? I mean, there's many. I think one thing I will say, besides, we could get into pyramids and shit. People just like to stack stones in a triangle. I know that's going to piss people off, whatever, but it's just, I think that is the case. It's just Occam's razor. People built the pyramids. People built the pyramids with stone chisels and bronze chisel, or sorry, people built the pyramids with bronze and iron chisels eventually and just built them. And they did it in some sophisticated way that we haven't fully understood yet, although I think people have it pretty figured out. But I mean, there's always people saying, oh, I don't, you know, we don't know how they did it. And Rogan always says this, but like, you can't, they're so precise, you can't stick a paper in between the stones. Have you been to the pyramids and touched them, bro? Have you been, there's someone listening right now. If you're like, that's too precise. Have you been to Cairo and put, I bet when you look at those stones, you could probably fit your fist in between some of the stones because it's old and falling apart. But I know in the spirit of what they're saying, you can't stick a credit card or piece of paper in there. Sure. But I don't think it's that precise. That's just a trope that's been said and regurgitated a bunch to where people believe it. But that's besides the point. There may have been ancient tech and stuff like that that we don't, like, whether it was the water system or building the pyramid from the top down. I saw that on a recent video that seems to have pretty good support. That's a whole thing. I'll link the video here so you can remember. But it was, you're stacking the stones up in a square kind of formation and then chiseling it into a triangle as you go down, if that makes sense. But that's besides the point. Another thing that I will say does drive me crazy is when people say, this is what archaeologists don't want you to know. This is what archaeologists, this is what they don't teach you in school. Why don't they teach you this in school? Here's the reason why. Perfect example. When you're in school, you learn that the Louisiana Purchase came because the U.S. purchased it from France. Full stop. Lewis and Clark then happened, blah, blah, blah. That's how we got the Louisiana Purchase. When you're six, or whatever, you're eight in school when you learn that, maybe 10, great. Or maybe you're even in high school, you're 15 when you learn that, right? All you need to know, we bought it from France. The actual context of that is Napoleon was getting a little too silly in Europe and completely bankrupted the French economy because it was already in shambles because Haiti had just revolted, and that was their huge cash crop and sugar plantations coming from Haiti, completely revolted, they lost all that money. And then Napoleon was like, hey, let's go to Moscow, guys. And they were like, all right, let's do it. Round two, let's try it. And they did it. Completely bankrupted the economy. He then sold the Louisiana Purchase to Thomas Jefferson, like, at dirt cheap cost, simply because, one, he needed the money, and two, he didn't want the British to occupy that land from Canada and take over previous French territory. Because, one, pride, and then, two, might as well have the ally of the Americans owning that territory instead. Here's the money at a discount. You can't explain the Haitian Revolution, you can't explain Napoleon, you can't explain all that to a kid in fifth grade and try to have them remember it on the test when they also have acne and they're learning geometry and 20 minutes later in the next class after the bell rings, you know? There's all that going on. You can't explain all of that to children that fast. That's what I think this problem is with archaeology, where it's like, they don't tell you this and they don't tell you about the Mississippians yet. Because it's easier to learn about Greece and Rome and China, because those are the major civilizations. I think you do learn about the Mississippians a lot of the times in archaeology classes, and maybe in some history classes, especially if you grew up in St. Louis or along the Mississippi River, you do learn about the Mississippians because you take field trips to mounds and stuff like that. But when you grow up in California, you grow up in New York, you don't learn about that because it's just specific. I learned about the Iroquois growing up in New York all the time and how they influenced the American government. And how the, you know, New York being the frontier, like Western New York upstate was like the frontier for a while and stuff like that. You learn all about that, but it's again, environmentally and contextually dependent. And a lot of times archaeological topics are just so difficult to grasp because, one, archaeologists are terrible at explaining shit. And then, two, a lot of it's just very complex. It involves multidisciplinary things like the Monteverde video. That is a lot of geochemistry, geology, and geologic processes and environmental processes that explain how that site may or may not be pre-Clovis or whatever. But there's been rebuttals to it now that are coming out. I'm going to have them on the show or at least talk about it at some point when it's all out. It's environmentally... But yeah, a lot of archaeological topics are just very complex to explain to people. Especially children, and children only understand archaeology. They're like, oh, is it a dinosaur or pyramids and things like that? Like, you can't really explain it all. So I think that's part of it. It's complicated, you know? I think there should be more archaeology and anthropology in schools. It might be a better country if everyone had a little, just a smidge of anthropology or sociology when they're in high school. I think that'd be great. Or at least to be more accepting of other cultures and things like that. But that's one of those things that, like, I think America gets branded as just like super racist country and stuff like that, that, you know, they're racist, they hate everybody. Everyone I've ever met has been extremely kind and nice. There are some very racist people out there for sure. Like, you're watching this right now and you're like, well, my grandpa, so, yeah, sure. But like, overall, if a black guy walks into the room, no one's gonna be like, get out. It's just like, hey, how you doing? You know, that's how America goes. I forget what got me on this tangent here. Oh, right, that anthropology could be useful to everybody. Because I believe my professor said this, but there's two types of people in the world. You have Somali neighbors move next door. They're from Somalia. There's people that will open up the blinds and, like, you know, peek through the blinds and look and be like, what the fuck are they doing, you know? Or there's people that are really like, oh, we got new neighbors, we should invite them over. The two different kinds of people. Maybe there's an in-between there, everything's a spectrum, but I lean more towards the other side, being like, oh, you want to come over? I bet they have really cool Somali food. I'd love to try it. What's Islam like? Do you like it? I don't know. Like, I'd rather do that than be like, get out, you know? I'd rather be curious. So that's what I mean by anthropology. Okay, digging a hole here. I think that is, let's answer one more dog question to wrap this up. If you could travel back in time to any place in history, any moment, where would you go? I would travel to the Paleolithic people in Siberia that domesticated dogs. I think I've said this before too. I would like to go to Jerusalem at the height of the Roman Empire just to see all of those people that were there and all of the spices and stuff that were coming in and out, the languages, the cultures. You get to see a show when they crucified Jesus, but you know, you might miss the ticket. You need the early access or whatever. Not that I want to see that, just it was an event that happened. But just seeing all those languages and people that came through, that's one thing, right? The other thing would be going to that Ice Age village and seeing, we don't know what their language was. We don't know what their clothing was. We know they had it, but we don't know what it looked like. Was it decorated? Did they have cool shells all over it? Did they paint it? Were their faces painted? Were they tattooed? I don't know. Did they have really cool stories? What did they think about mammoths? They hunted them. Do you think they hated them? Was there an eternal battle between people? Or did they feel sympathy for the mammoth when they hunted it? I don't know. These are questions I would like to know. How they organized their society. Was there a shaman? Were they a matriarchy? Did they bang in public? Did they do it in private? Did they have children? Did they have marriage? Did they have, you know, sexual relations in public or in private? I think in Polynesia, it was like a public event or something like that. It's a specific island. I can't exactly remember. Don't quote me. But things like that. Because you see all these snippets of culture around the world and you wonder, like, oh, did that all stem from Ice Age hunter-gatherers existing on the landscape or something like that? That was a weird topic to go on there, but you know what I'm saying? Just different sacred and profane things. Could they curse? Were they able to name names? Did they have a gender? Did they have multiple genders? Did they have no concept of it? Were they homosexual? Like, things like that. You don't know? I'd like to know that. Do I want to go back to the Clovis period in Wyoming and see if two of them were, like, homosexual men? Netflix will probably cover that before, you know, time machine's invented, but that's something you could wonder. Like, did they have that? Did they have this? Did it was murder? If somebody murdered somebody, were they killed? You know, things like, questions like that in society that we have no idea how they lived. All of that stuff is gone. We just have rocks and a few bones left to figure this all out. So that was a weird way to end this conversation, but the first people that domesticated dogs, what was the interaction like? How did that happen? Were wolves the ones that initiated it? Were humans initiated it? What happened there? I think that would be really fun to know. So with that, I think that is it. If you have more questions like these, please put them in the comments or shoot me an email or a message on Instagram. I'll try to factor this in the next one. I'll try to do this every few months or so because I enjoyed this episode. Easy to put out, nice, easy edit. All right. Well, with that was, I think 10, maybe we got to 10, 12, 8. We'll figure it out in the post. All right. Thank you very much. Please do not forget. You can go to fluent.pet/David to get 5% off my course on the history of dogs. If you want to learn everything I know about the history of dogs, my lecture is on YouTube for free. It's an hour, but if you want 3 hours of more information, in-depth stuff that I didn't cover here today or in that lecture, that is fluent.pet/David. You can also go to my Patreon. Please sign up for that for early access to videos and things like that. And as well, if you want to buy stickers, prints, merch, anything like that from the illustrations that Atori does, or my logo as a sticker or t-shirts, anything like that, hats, gloves, dog bowl, I think it's all on the website. That's davidianhow.com/store. And please don't forget to rate and review the podcast. Check out all the fun, exciting podcasts that are on the Archaeology Podcast Network, including The Archaeology Show, which is a great one. So thank you very much, and we are out.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.